I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
In the race to decarbonize our economy, many of us are looking at green technologies and energy sources to help us with the transition. Wind turbines, solar panels, and electric cars have been touted as clean and sustainable pathways to a future without fossil fuels. But as we are learning this week, developing of these technologies may come with its own price for the environment.
In this episode, we're speaking with Cyril Martin, a policy expert at Ocean Care, who's leading the charge to understand and reduce the impacts of deep sea mining. Deep sea mining is used to harvest many of the metals, like cobalt and nickel, that are used in building solar panels and electric cars. While we absolutely must get off of fossil fuels, we also have to be very careful not to damage the ecosystems of our ocean along the way.
Cyril tells us more.
Hi, I'm Cyril Martin. I'm a lawyer and I work for Ocean Care. And Ocean Care, what the name already says, cares about the ocean. So it's an ocean conservation organization. It's based in Switzerland. We are pretty small. We are 11 people in Switzerland and we have some international collaborators. We have scientists, we have ocean policy experts, and we of course have the fundraising communication parts. And we're working pretty internationally. We're working in many, many international organizations. And me myself, I'm developing a new program here at Ocean Care on deep sea mining. So mining of metallic raw materials from the deep sea, which is a kind of an upcoming business and with a lot of unknowns and potential threats to the ocean, not only to the deep sea, but to the whole ocean. So that's why we developed this new program. We just started in December, actually. That's when I entered Ocean Care. I worked for the Swiss government before, for the foreign ministry. And because I'm, as a lawyer, I was focusing and I have certain expertise in the law of the sea and also environmental shipping stuff I did before. So that's how I entered the arena of NGO and ocean conservation.
Very interesting. So the world of ocean mining, can you describe what countries are involved and what kind of minerals are coming out of the ocean and why you see it as a growth industry?
All right. So you asked what countries are involved. Well, there's a plethora of countries, but I mean, we can distinguish countries that are interested in developing the deep ocean. So in bringing these raw materials up, and these are dispersed pretty much around the globe, but talking about leaders, probably there are some Asian countries at the forefront. So Japan is very advanced in deep sea mining, especially when it comes to deep sea mining within their own national waters. They have a very very advanced technology, and China is doing a lot, but also South Korea is very active. We have other important players. Russia is in the business. I mean, you have also European countries, of course. You have like France, Germany, which is doing a lot of research in the area. We have Belgium, a very powerful mining company, and many more. So we have, I'm not sure if I picked the right number now, but it's about 31 contracts now with the International Seabed Authority that allows countries or contractors actually, that can be private companies too, to explore for these seafloor minerals.
What minerals are they and why are they important?
Yeah, we have, if we talk about deep sea mining broadly, we speak about three types of deep sea minerals. So that's the most popular best known one are the polymetallic nodules, which are kind of lumps, potato size, a bit smaller, can be a bit bigger. And they include interesting materials like cobalt and nickel and others. And they are lying loosely on the seafloor, on deep sea plains. So they can be picked up. And then there are two other types like polymetallic sulfides, and they accumulate around these hydrothermal vents. Like those are outlets of volcanic activity deep down the ocean, and these minerals, they accumulate around, in and around them, these mounds. And we have ferromanganese crusts. These are minerals that accumulate on mainly on the slopes of sea mountains, deep sea mountains. And they all have kind of different mineral composition, but so the main minerals, the main metals are all very important, for example, in producing batteries for the e-mobility, or also, for example, in for solar energy, they're needed, or in for magnets in wind turbines and all kinds of high-tech stuff too.
So can you compare this exploitation of it's the seafloor, really, isn't it? Is it comparable to sort of like kind of a gold rush, you know, like what we had in all over the world, but specifically in, I guess, Arizona, isn't it? Like Southwest
California,
where people come in and kind of, I guess it's company, first of all, right? It's probably companies, not private people who come in and want to mine. But how can you describe it, and what depth is it?
Yeah, so the gold rush is a good term, but different to the gold rush, you kind of just go to the deep sea and have your little net and try to get some gold out of a river, something this needs tremendous amounts of investment and technology to reach the deep sea. And you ask about the depth. So some deposits start at like 800 meters. These are like the polymetallic sulfides that come highest up, and then it's up to down to 6,500 meters below sea surface for the polymetallic nodules that land these abyssal plains. So it's very, very deep down. So there are many obstacles to get there, of course. You have to develop the technology, and you have to have investors who are willing to take the risk, of course, because it's a highly risky undertaking. You're not sure if it's going to turn out well, if your return on investment is really going to bring you somewhere. And the biggest issue, that there is a tremendous amount of potential for environmental destruction.
So what does that look like, the environmental destruction? What are the risks exactly?
Well, it works on many different levels. So for example, let's turn to these polymetallic nodules that are lying loosely on the seafloor. It sounds very convenient. You can just pick them, right? But these are very, very important habitats and substrates for many species. Just to have an illustration, for example, there are some species growing on it, some sponges. And these sponges, for example, they are needed for these, you've probably heard of this cute Casper octopus, this ghost octopus who lives in the deep sea. It can be quite, became quite iconic in the media. And they, for example, they need these sponges to lay their eggs there. So they cannot exist without that. And all these species that need to be attached to a solid fundament, to a solid base, they need these solid rocks because, these lumps, because around there's just these loose sediments. So if you take this away, it's not going to come back, because it takes millions of years for these minerals and materials to accumulate around small particles, as shark teeth, for example. So if you take them away, it's gone. So the habitat is destroyed and never coming back. So that's one big issue. And then, of course, within the process, let's stay with these polymetallic nodules, because these are the most prominent ones right now. So also you need the machines that are the collector machines that are running around on the seafloor, and they're creating sediment plumes. So they're stirring up all the material from the floor. And with that, also changing the composition of the seawater. I mean, there are particles flying around all of a sudden, and these can be smoldering and also suffocating many animals that live there on the floor. I mean, particularly the ones who cannot move away, the ones who are either very slow moving or they're sessile. So that's another big issue. But that's just talking about the very lowest parts. And then you go all the way up, because these minerals, they need to be transported upwards to the surface, of course, through a riser system. This riser system has many, many pumps, for example, and these pumps, they create noise on the way up. They already create noise near the seafloor. The machinery on the seafloor creates noise, and probably not so much for the collection of polymetallic nodules. But if you look at cobalt crust or polymetallic sulfides that are solid and are stuck to the ground. You need to chip them and drill them off the ground, and that creates also a lot of sound, a lot of noise. And then you go all the way up to the ships. These ships, to stay in place, they use dynamic positioning systems. These are thrusters that are very loud, and they're active almost all the time because the ship has to stay in position so that the riser system that leads down to these machines on the seafloor is not like cracked or something. And so noise is a big issue, and I'm kind of pointing this out because we're working on the right now on the issue of underwater noise emissions from deep sea mining. But there are others too. There is like light emissions near the seafloor. I mean, you have to imagine that the deep sea is completely dark, and species are using bioluminescence or other measures of light communication, for example, or to attack prey, to hunt, or sometimes also to avoid prey. And this, of course, if you introduce a light source, this will interfere with these processes. Similarly to noise, by the way, noise is used for communication, for mating, for foraging, for predator avoidance. And if you introduce noise, you make it hard for these animals to use their normal hearing capability, or noise sensing capability is probably more appropriate to say. And also some of the noises emitted are being very, very loud. That can lead up to permanent injuries in animals.
Yeah, it sounds horrible. You know, like a disaster, yet another human-made disaster waiting to happen. What kind of solutions do you think about when you think about regulating deep-sea mining, or maybe even banning deep-sea mining?
Well, as you said, it's very varying, and I wasn't even done naming all the environmental effects that are expected, because openly speaking, we don't know what's going to happen. We have certain indications. We can extrapolate from other habitats that we actually know, because we know so little about the deep sea. So we don't know what species exactly live there. We don't know how they sense noise, for example, or how they hunt, how they live, how they mate, whatever. That is very hard. So there's a huge knowledge gap at this moment. But coming back to your question on regulation, so a very important step would be, and you probably heard about this, is to have a pause before proceeding now with these extracting activities, because we just need much more time to study the deep sea, to study the ecosystems, not only the deep sea, but the whole ecosystems, because this is all interlinked, all the different layers of water, species living there, also their functions when it comes to CO2 storage. And we need just so much more research on this. And for this we need a little air, of course, because this cannot be done like in 1-2 years and then, okay, we know everything, let's proceed or let's decide. So we need this science and these investigations to be able to decide, okay, to what extent would the impact harm the marine environment, to be able then to make a decision, okay, is it worth the risk? Because of course there will be a growing demand in these metals that I named for the e-mobility, for example, which is important for the energy transition, of course. And so there are certain, let's say, sound interests in having more raw materials. But we need to make sure, if we source these raw materials, that they're not, again, just very harmful to the environment and undermining our primary effort. And we're not in a position right now to make this decision. So that's the first thing. So this pause we call a moratorium. So that is just very important. And we think that at least for this UN Decade of Ocean Science should be until 2030, this should be used. And at least for this period, there should be a pause in advancing deep sea mining. But of course, not everybody thinks like that. That's clearly a conservation position. But you also asked about regulation, and we have to distinguish a little bit. If you're mining the deep sea within I call them, it's not the correct term in legal terms, but like national waters. So where the coastal states have jurisdiction, and the international waters, where the international seabed is. And the international seabed is governed by a body called the International Seabed Authority, which has kind of a double mandate. So it should be, it should regulate and mandate the use of the resources of the deep sea, of the international sea floor. So it's called the area, the international deep sea floor. But it also has the mandate to effectively protect these habitats. And the International Seabed Authority is the place where regulations are developed for exploitation, but also for protection of the deep sea floor. So also when it comes to the regulations, the best thing would be to wait a little, to have more evidence, to have more knowledge. But of course, you can already create regulations. You just have to be very, very careful. And these regulations need to be even the more stringent and more, also more restrictive probably, unless we know more. Then you can probably loosen them a little bit because you can say, okay, that's not that harmful, that's acceptable. Yeah.
So are the countries that are beginning to do this kind of mining, are they mindful of the environmental impacts, or do you think are they companies that are trying to lobby those countries for that access? Who's on the side of the seafloor, and who's on the side of humanity?
There's a variety, I think. So there are some countries who are well aware of the environmental consequences, and I guess all of them know that it's not an easy thing. So there will be harmful impacts, but it depends which interests have more weight, of course. I mean, that's a very general assumption, but maybe going to the second part of your question, talking about companies, private companies that are trying to exert their influence, and that happens a lot indeed, because all the private companies, they kind of just go to the International Seabed Authority and ask them to give them a license to mine or also to explore. They need a state sponsor for this. So a state sponsor needs to be a member of the International Seabed Authority, which are pretty much all the countries, all the UN countries, not all, but getting close to it. So, and these private companies, they are indeed pushing. I mean, you have to imagine that if you're interested in developing deep sea minerals, this is a high risk undertaking. A lot of unknowns, you need a lot of money to even start, to even develop your technology, to even, and then also test it in the field, which has still to be done with most of the parts, with most of the components. So this is a high risk undertaking. So you need to have a certainty that you can proceed or at least go to a certain point so that you get this money in the first place. And we have, right now, we have a very good example of a dynamic happening. You probably heard of the Nauru case. So Nauru, this small Pacific island state that is a member of the International Seabed Authority and which has a national company called NORI, is the short term. And they applied now at the International Seabed Authority that the adoption and the creation of the regulations should be sped up. They pulled a clause, which is within the 1994 agreement, amending the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and pretty much forcing the International Seabed Authority now to complete their regulations and so on within 2 years. And if they're not completed, an interested party, particularly this NORI company, can apply for on provisional basis on an exploitation license. And if you remember what I said before, that you need a lot of time to understand the issue better, to make good relations, this is absolutely insane to be very open, to have this going on within 2 years. And you also asked what's the company background, because this NORI company is effectively controlled by a Canadian mining company called Deep Green, soon to be called the Metals Company, because they're merging and going public with a SPAC the special purpose acquisition company. And they're pushing very hard to get Deep Sea Mine going. Of course, they have to if they want to attract investors. At least I assume this. And so, yeah, it's pretty obvious that there is a strong company and a lot of company and commercial interests behind this push forward. But ironically, if you read, I don't know, probably you've seen the letter of Nauru to the International Seabed Authority, where they're actually argumenting that they have this history, this painful history of they're attributed to colonialism, that they have been exploited, and now they will be able to do their own mining operations to diversify their economy and so on. And but if you look behind the scenes, of course, it's exactly the same thing that's happening, because the most of the income, I mean, this is just assumptions, of course, but will probably flow to the shareholders of a big Western mining company. And but the whole risk for the environmental degradation and the liability also would most probably stay with the sponsoring states, which is a small Pacific Island state. And yeah, so it's very interesting, and but it's very concerning too.
Yeah, and disappointing.
It's like the typical vicious circle of how we have settled up the system, which is basically not creating a win-win situation, and certainly not caring for the environment, exploitation, putting nothing back. I guess the research is also not sponsored, because who wants to know what we are actually destroying in the first place? Right? I mean, there is no interest in, I guess, I mean, you tell me, maybe it's a highly financed research.
Well, to a certain extent, there's financing of research, and I'm clearly not familiar with all the research projects going on. I don't know, but for example, if you look at what Germany or France, they're doing a lot of research actually in the deep sea context, and this is probably not so much sponsored by private companies, but there's the European Union, for example, sponsoring a lot within its huge scientific programs. And this is also criticized, by the way, because there's public money given to open the floor to a commercial activity that is probably very highly destructive. But yeah, but of course you need to go there and you need to look. The thing is that, as far as I know, the commercial companies, if they're doing research, they're doing research focused on their business, of course. So just an example, right now some companies are testing their collector devices in the Pacific. So they're checking, okay, is this really working out? Can they pick up these nodules? How? And then they're, for example, they are assessing to a certain extent if plumes are created, sediment plumes. Some, very little of them, are to a very, very limited extent, are assessing also noise emissions from their collector devices, for example. But if you really look into the subject, what needs to be measured? I mean, first there needs to be baseline studies. I mean, we need to know what's there and how this is functioning and how, for example, sounds are used in the deep ocean or light or whatever. And then the next stage is to see, okay, what is coming, what is introduced newly with these technologies and these undertakings. And of course, already the baseline thing is missing. There are provisions. You need to do certain baseline studies if you also want to do certain exploratory activities, but it's clearly not sufficient. This is just a very little thing. Of course, what can you do if you have some month or two little years to proceed with your project? You just do the little things that are asked of you. But for example, the noise issue. So you to have just a picture of what noise emissions were there, you need hydrophones, you need the noise on different levels of the ocean. You need to assess the noise emitted by the ships, and not only by the production vessel, but also by the offtake vessels, by the supply vessels, by the monitoring vessels, by the submersibles. And there's also like the whole exploration with acoustic devices, with sonars, also seismic when it comes very bad, which is extremely loud and extremely disturbing, creating a lot of noise in the surroundings. And this is not measured at all. So we are very, very far away from that's actually where we try to jump in and also to show this, to show, okay, what's missing, particularly when it comes to the noise issue. what knowledge is there, what knowledge is not there, and what needs to be done, and what at least as a minimum standard can be taken from other agreements that worked on this for many, many years, because it's not working something out of nothing.
I have this map, so you're talking about one problem, which is then has the arm of another problem. This has like children of problems, and these have like grandchildren of problems, and they have grand-grandchildren of problems. So we have this
strand
of problems you're describing, right? From one issue, which is the deep sea mining. Cyril, this may be a little bit more personal question, but you just opened up this whole universe of problems. And you are basically a lawyer working in Zurich. How do you deal with this on a personal level? It's maybe a bit of a personal question, but...
No. It's very interesting, and it's an important question, because it's actually what drives us to try to change something. And I mean, the first thing is probably just curiosity that keeps me going after this issue, because as you said, it's like it's a huge beast with many, many tentacles, and it touches on so many subjects. It's extremely interesting to try to get to understand all the interlinkages. And I think it's also very interesting to have these very, very current issues like with climate change and with energy transition involved. And of course, in your everyday life, you think, well, should I buy an electric car now, or should I still use the carbon stuff? And I don't have a car myself, so, but which is possible in Switzerland, not everywhere I'm aware. But then it helps to be critical also towards the new technologies. But it doesn't mean just closing your eyes and say, well, yeah, that's getting away from carbon, so it's very good, it's all perfect, and let's forget about where it's coming from. So there's this, coming back to the personal motivation, probably an interest in tackling these issue and trying to make people more aware of that. If you want real change, then it has to be a real change. It cannot be just change as a nice wrapping paper and then there's the whole rotten bunch inside again. So that's not working. But the other thing is also, I think, is very important that one should be very realistic. And I think it's very helpful also that Ocean Care is a very realistic and cooperative organization. So we're not like the loud activists. Of course, we have public campaigns sometimes and we have clear standings, but we're trying to work on also through diplomatic channels and talk to all the stakeholders, get to know what's going on, get to know their positions, and always trickle in our positions and try to get them where we want to have them in small steps over long periods of time. But for this, you have to be realistic. Of course, if you're talking to somebody from a mining company, this person has clearly different interests than you, different core interests, even though this person is probably the head of CSR or something, but you're coming from a different world. You're getting money, your money from a different bunch of stakeholders. I mean, we have donors that pay us so that we make so we care for the ocean, right? So others pay a mining company because they want to have a return on investment or whatever. So you have to be very aware of that, and also not being, of course, but that's a very general assumption, not to be naive. I mean, I know I can work my ass off all day and all weekend and all holidays, but probably deep sea mining is still going to happen and there will be huge impacts on the environment, but we as an organization would be very happy if we can make like these small amendments. I mean, already if we are able to help to have better regulations, for example, or just to look at my country, Switzerland. We're clearly landlocked, so far away from the ocean, but still we have a lot of huge companies sitting in Switzerland that are involved and investing in deep sea mining. And in mining in general, and it's one of the major hubs for trading of raw materials. So, but many, many Swiss people are not aware, of course, of the deep sea mining issue. I mean, many people around the world, but here we didn't even have a discussion on the political level yet, because it's just not, well, nobody touched on it, and there's no pressure from the general public or from NGOs. And but fortunately, we had last month, we had the first question within the Swiss Parliament on the topic. And so there's, yeah, there's it's small steps to take. So I think, getting back to your questions, having high aims, but being ready to take small steps to achieve them.
Great advice. I mean, I think all of us face these overwhelming problems, and sometimes it's hard to feel satisfied by the small steps, but that's what's available to us. I wonder how likely it will be to have a moratorium, and what can our listeners do to support a moratorium that would allow for the kind of knowledge gathering that you recommend?
Well, what are the chances? That's very hard to say, because especially now after Nauru pulled this two-year trigger clause at the International Seabed Authority, so that makes it clearly harder. So it's hard to foresee if there is going to be enough support of member states within the International Seabed Authority that that are critical mass to halt the process, because the International Seabed Authority is also designed that it's very hard beyond the technical level, where a lot of experts, let's say, not adverse to deep sea mining are sitting. So it's on the decision maker on the political level, it's very hard to get the necessary majorities. But yeah, let's see. I mean, we're working on it, but am I confident? I don't know. It's very open, but yeah.
How many experts in deep sea mining do you think there are in the world?
No idea.
No?
Definitely no idea, but I'm probably not the right person to ask you.
It seems like it would be less than 1,000. Like, you could put them all in a room, probably. And
it's possible.
Have a conversation about how do we protect the ocean. You're the expert, right? You understand these deep sea. What if we took a different kind of approach? We brought all of those experts together and say, okay, what are we? How are we going to do this without the destruction that looks like it's going to cause?
I mean, that's actually what a lot of scientists are trying to do also within the International Seabed Authority, but also outside of it. For example, there is the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative, the DOSI, you're probably aware of. These are deep sea scientists being on the scientific side, very active. They have, by the way, they have a very good newsletter, which I can recommend to people in the subject, which is scientific, but also has like media on the topic. And yeah, there are not too many. And as you said, it's already very important, very, very difficult. So I myself, you honored me as a deep sea specialist, but I'm a lawyer. So I'm familiar with the law of the sea. And of course, working on these subjects, you get close to it and you get to understand it better. But for example, when we want to make a publication, what we're working right now, and you want to address a subject, for example, like deep sea mining, underwater noise, impacts on marine species, then you need to go and look around what experts are there and who could, I mean, there are no experts on all these areas. So you need probably a deep sea biologist, you need a noise expert, like an acoustician or something, or a biologist with a particular expertise. And then you need somebody who has also accumulated the knowledge on the geologic parts, for example, and also on the technology. That is very hard, because you probably also would need an engineer and then a lawyer to understand the regulations and everything. So as you said, it's a very good idea. It's actually something we also have in mind, that if you want to, in regulating these activities, if you want to have the state of the art included, and then you need to take the most high profile experts on the areas touched, and you bring them together and you let them sort out the issue in a workshop, and probably a series of workshops. So that should be done. But of course, this also needs time. It needs money. And it needs, of course, the focus on the protection issue, not the focus on the short-term financial gains.
Yeah. What's very peculiar in this issue is that we basically don't know yet what really is at stake. We know that there is a lot at stake, but basically when I understood correctly, we actually don't know yet what really is at stake.
We know part of it. Of course, we know that
part of it, yes.
If the habitat is destroyed, it's destroyed. Wait. It's not going to come back, not within our time frames, and not within those of these species too.
Next million years.
So, but of course, all we don't know exactly how these carbon storages, all these cycles work, for example. And I mean, there we touch on a small part here, but we touch on a very ironic angle, because if you're trying to get these minerals out of the ocean to make car batteries to avoid CO2 emissions, and at the same time you destroy very important ecosystem services of the ocean storing the carbon, well, then that doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah,
so we should be very, very aware of that. Yeah.
It's as usual, it's super interesting and time flies. Cyril, maybe is there anything we haven't asked you where you think like this is very close to your heart and you really want to bring this out? So any issue, anything you would really want to say?
Or conclusion.
Yeah, probably something I think I didn't ask the whole, respond to the whole one of the questions, because the question was also what can the general public do, or your listeners do, to advance the topic. So the first thing is to read and to learn about deep sea mining, because there is a lot in the media, and if you don't like to read, there's also a lot of webinars and very attractive cartoons sometimes. So I strongly suggest also to visit the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition homepage. It's very easy to find, also the DOSI homepage. So there's plenty of information to get. First, you need to know what's it about, and then you should start to ask questions about it. It's always very good to ask also your friends, for example, if they're buying a new fancy Tesla, for example. You can ask them, oh well, like cool, okay, it's fancy, it's fast, it's very modern, it's very fashionable, but where are the minerals coming from for the battery, for example? So not to be aggressive or to upset them, but just to make them start
thinking.
Exactly. Create awareness. Thank you. And also ask your politicians. I mean, it depends very much in which political system you live, of course. But in many countries, you have the opportunity to write letters to politicians, or also to start initiatives if you have more resources at your hands. So that they realize, okay, this is an issue. And even if maybe some of them are aware that there is an issue, if they're not, it's good also to create awareness. But if they are, it's good to create awareness that there are people looking at it and asking critical questions. And that's not that hard to do, actually. So that's probably something I would definitely suggest. And coming back to the things, to the you named it personal questions, so the... how to get there, how to keep up the motivation. So take the small steps and celebrate them, because this is very, very important. And I can at the end disclose that before I became a lawyer, I was a psychologist. I'm also a bit familiar with behavioral studies and stuff. So create your small successes and don't be too hard on yourself, even if you're not always environmentally friendly, but keep on track.
Cyril, thank you so much. This has been eye-opening for us. I think to learn about the deep sea, it adds a whole new layer of scary stuff to think about, but very important. And we really appreciate your time.
What Cyril is describing is really, for me, a perfect example of exploitation economy.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make sense at all. Like, we take and we never give back. Someone gets rich. He has this wonderful term, return of investment. What's the return of it? And this, you know, I've heard this so many times. Oh, where's my return of investment? And you when kind of like, yeah, what is the return of investment? We forgot the actual costs.
Right.
The externalized costs are not even close. We don't even consider it. It's not even obvious, right? And then we don't even know what we're destroying. I mean, that's the particular part.
in his story.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that the majority of the minerals that are being mined, though, are an attempt to provide natural resources for our quote-unquote solutions to climate change, like
right.
Tesla batteries. And you know, so there, it also demonstrates kind of that, not only that cycle that you're talking, vicious cycle, but also this idea that we're not being conscious about the solutions to the problems that we're facing, to the vast problems we're facing. We're creating even more vast problems. And, you know, it's a bit depressing, I gotta say. But I think it is fundamentally about economics. I mean, the motive to do this is because there's a market and you can sell those minerals for a very high price because you're going very deep to get them. And so companies are motivated to do that. Damn the
yeah, exactly. And one does understand the high risk those companies are taking.
Yeah, they're investing a lot of money. But,
you know, within that economic system, I can see how arguments are shifted to the conclusion we have to do this.
Right. But he brings up a really interesting, you know, very specific example of this island of Nauru. And I don't know if you know about this island, but
it's
in Micronesia, very, very small island. I think it has 12,000 residents. And they discovered phosphorescent rocks there, and they started to mine them. And it went from this kind of tranquil little tropical island to a complete, an uninhabitable wasteland. The entire island, you can look it up online, it looks like a bunch of rubble. And there's nothing growing there. There's no one, only places where people live is right directly on the coastline.
Right.
And these are the people yet who are also arguing that they should be able to deep sea mine because they were cheated out of their natural resources by colonists, right? And they came in and exploited. Yet the cycle continues. And you know, for me, all I can picture is the entire planet looking like Nauru. But it's just like, when are we going to figure out that we have to stop this? We have to become regenerative thinkers. We have to, when we take, we have to give back. When are we going to figure that out?
Yeah, I wonder, you know, if though, this it's here we are. This is kind of hopeful on Cyril's side, I have to admit, for the episode, even though he has opened this window to all these problems, big deep sea issue to all these tentacles of problems, or red tail problems, right? But there still seems to be a chance to stop it, to give it a break until we may have enough research, maybe we have enough scientific facts to decide maybe not to do it, you know, and maybe that pause would kind of save what will be lost forever if this industry goes on. And there, I mean, I hope, you know, somewhere there is a spark in me where I hope, we have had so many examples of destruction, complete destruction, as the island of Nauru, what you just gave. Can we learn from this? And maybe this is an opportunity to stop that exploit. It has not been done yet. Normally we talk about things which were done, so wasteland, and then we want to turn into Wonderland. Here we are still on the brink, like, ooh, we still have a chance to stop this.
Yeah, we don't have to go wasteland.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.